inviting diverse thought leaders to explore topics designed to spark our collective imagination. Welcome to AKQA Insight.
A lot of people believe that in times of crisis we turn into savages and that our civilization is only a thin veneer. But actually there's a huge amount of evidence that exactly in times like this, we push a reset button in our brain and we go back to our better selves and you get this explosion of cooperation. People have evolved to be friendly. But being friendly is not the same as being good. Actually, if you want to be a good person, quite often you need to be very unfriendly. You need to be willing to go against the status quo. Because so often progress starts with people who are very unfriendly. So if you want to change the world, think about how you can change the school that you sent your kids to. Think about how you can change the workplace, how you can change prisons or the way we do democracy. Because I mean, these institutions produce society and they change the people around you, including yourself.
Today, we welcome Rutger Bregman, journalist, historian, and author of Humankind, A Hopeful History, and 2017's Utopia for Realists. You might know Rutger for his ability to speak truth to power so effectively. Some of his viral moments have seen him taking aim at Fox News host Tucker Carlson, and even at last year's World Economic Forum at Davos, where he challenged the world's wealthy elite to talk about taxes as a solution to systemic inequality. Utopia for Realists laid out his argument for universal basic income, open borders, and a 15-hour workweek as important and achievable goals. His latest book, Humankind, proposes, I guess, an alternative view of humanity where nature is based on trust and solidarity, which sounds just like the view we need in 2020. I'm your host, Chris Henderson, Managing Director of AKQA in Amsterdam, and I'm delighted to chat with Rutger about human kindness and our lesser-known hopeful history. I guess I'd like to kick off by saying I think of myself as a bit of an optimist. I'd like to think I'm an optimist. But I have to be honest, my optimism is being challenged of late. There are a lot of long-standing endemic problems, as well as many recent political, economical, and environmental events that are making me doubt human nature, to put it in your terms. The cynic would have you believe that humanity is, I guess, inherently callous, that we're predisposed to violence and strife. But Rutger, I think you put forward a powerful argument that we as humans were not necessarily always this way, nor do we have to think of ourselves this way moving forward. And at a time when the world can seem particularly hopeless, your book is a timely reaffirmation that humanity also has the power to do some good. I'm delighted to welcome you to AKQA Insight. Welcome, Rutger.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
So you're in the middle of a book tour, a virtual book tour. How's it going for you?
It's a very strange experience doing everything from this provincial town that I live in called Houten. It's a little bit to the south of Utrecht in the Netherlands. And but you can do everything from home, right?
So we've certainly found that out over the last few months.
Sometimes it takes a while with technical issues, but you know, once you're up and going. So yeah, it's been a strange experience. But then at the same time, it seems to me that, you know, the things I talk about in my book are quite relevant for this moment. Actually, the first two chapters in the book are about how people respond to crisis, like a pandemic or a natural disaster, something like that. And yeah, a lot of people believe that in times of crisis, we turn into savages, that we turn out to be these selfish, nasty people, and that our civilization is only a thin veneer. But actually, there's a huge amount of evidence that exactly in times like this, we push a reset button in our brain and we go back to our better selves and you get this explosion of cooperation.
You've done a lot of research and thinking, I guess, the notion that humanity has a powerful preference for our good side, mm-hmm. And that it was kind of the advent of civilization that led us to more, to quote, violent and nefarious ways of being. Mm-hmm. Can you explain this? Unravel that for me.
Sure. Well, we have to start with the realization that for 95% of our history, we lived our lives as nomadic hunter-gatherers. So that's really the environment in which we evolved. And it's obviously hard to know what life was like back then, because we don't exactly have a time machine or anything like that. But we do have powerful evidence from archaeology and anthropology, which shows that these lives that we lived back then were not nasty, brutish, and short, as the British philosopher Thomas Hobbes famously said, but that actually our lives were, you know, pretty good, with short working weeks of around 20, 30 hours, pretty healthy lives, varied diet, bit of fruit, bit of vegetables, bit of meat. There were no infection diseases, or at least not as much as we have right now, because we weren't living close to domesticated animals or living close to each other in cities. So no plague, no malaria, no COVID-19. And also these societies were quite egalitarian and peaceful. So no strict hierarchies. And also the evidence for warfare, well, there's very little of it. Warfare really seems to be a recent invention that starts when people settled down and started living in villages and cities, and when they invented agriculture. So indeed, if you zoom out a little bit and look at the vast majority of our existence as a species, for 95%, it was pretty good, I'd say. But then civilization arose, and the biggest part of the history of civilization was really quite a disaster, you know, when we moved into a world with much more violent, much more hierarchical, much more unhealthy. We have a bad memory for this because we've made so much progress, obviously, in the past couple of decades, especially after the Second World War. But if you zoom out a little bit and look at the grand scheme of things, civilization was actually a pretty bad idea.
You know, if you look at the history of the universe, humanity and civilization, if you put it on a 24-hour clock, starts at 11:59 and 30 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you believe there are some crucial turning points in our history and evolution where we did go from good to bad? Is it the Byzantine Empire, the Mesopotamians, the Roman? Hmm. Or how do you define these moments in time?
Well, for millennia, you know, back in the Stone Age, we had this process that biologists call survival of the friendliest, which means that for a long time, it was actually the friendliest among us who had the most kids and so had the biggest chance of passing on their genes to the next generation. The scientific term for this is self-domestication. We all know what domestication is, I think. You've got goats, you've got sheep, you've got cows, and they've been domesticated by us. We selected for tameness and for friendliness. And so, yeah, you start with a wolf and you end up with a chihuahua. That's basically what domestication is. And biologists have long known there's a list of traits that domesticated species have, the self-domestication syndrome, they call it. Thinner bones, smaller brains, and on average, just domesticated species look a little bit childish. Pedomorphic is a scientific term. So it seems they never grow up. And then you look at humans, and well, that seems a pretty accurate description of us, that we never really grow up. We look like baby chimpanzees, basically. We are domesticated apes. We have many of these traits of domesticated species. Now, the question is, who domesticated us? And the answer is, we did it ourselves. So for a very long time, it was actually evolutionary advantageous to have a lot of friends. Because in the Ice Age, how would you ever survive with having a lot of possessions? Well, you were not going to. Imagine Donald Trump in a harsh environment like that. He wouldn't have survived for long. People don't like narcissists. He would have died alone. If you had a lot of friends, then you did have a higher chance of passing on your genes to the next generation. Then, as I mentioned, everything changed around 10, 15,000 years ago. We settled down in Mesopotamia where life seemed to be much better. You know, it was a mild climate. It was also very easy and relaxed to start life as a farmer. So we basically walked into that trap. I think we should see it like that. And then when the circumstances changed again, when the climate changed again, and it became much harder to live as a farmer, then we couldn't go back anymore because centuries had already passed and old lifestyles and the knowledge of that was lost. And also, you know, farmer communities have a tendency to grow. You know, they have much higher population densities. So they push back the nomadic hunter-gatherer cultures. So it's like Hotel California. You go in and you can't get out anymore.
I mean, one of the premises of your books is based on the argument between Rousseau and Hobbes. Mm-hmm. And I want to understand from you whether you think that that's a binary contradiction or, like many things, is human nature a scale or a spectrum like sexuality, for say?
Yeah, well, it's not totally black and white, of course. So I think I agree with Rousseau for around 80%. It's interesting to me that Hobbes is often described as the realist, as the father of realism, with his, when he talks about the war of war against all that was going on in the state of nature. And then Rousseau is being dismissed as the romantic, the naive, the sentimentalist, etc., etc. I think that's really wrong. If you read On the Origin of Inequality by Rousseau, it's really astonishing to read that first and then look at the latest evidence we have from anthropology and archaeology and think, hey, wait a minute, this is quite similar, you know, they're reaching the same conclusions. I think that in the end, in the book, I arrive at a quite paradoxical view of human nature. So on the one hand, I argue that indeed people have evolved to be friendly, but being friendly is not the same as being good. Actually, if you want to be a good person, quite often you need to be very unfriendly. You need to be willing to go against the status quo, to be willing to be dismissed as nasty and difficult, because so often progress starts with people who are very unfriendly. Now, we don't remember that because history, you know, we often sanitize the heroes of the past. Think about Martin Luther King. Now we have this Martin Luther King Day in the US, and we think, oh, he was this great connector and people all loved him back in the 60s. Well, that's not true at all. He was a very polarizing figure. Most white Americans hated him. And that was exactly the point, because that's where progress comes from people who are willing to talk about the elephant in the room and who are willing to go against the status quo.
You know, growing up, going through school, you learn that human beings are social creatures. Our competitive advantage in the natural world is our ability to create social connections. I think the one thing that really stood out for me in your book is aligning that to survival of the friendliest. For me, that was something new and a point and an anecdote I hadn't heard before. So I really appreciated that. In light of recent events, I'd like our kind of conversation to be connected to what's happening in the world today. And as a creative industry and as a world, racial inequality, racial injustice is at the forefront of public discourse. In connecting racial equality and gender inequality, how does that fit into the argument? Are these systems or a construct of civilization, or are they the result of human nature?
Well, racism or groupishness or tribal thinking is very deeply embedded, I think, in human nature. We can see it in kids or even babies as young as 6 months old or a year old. There's really striking research from psychology who have recently discovered that at a very young age, kids can make the distinction between good and evil, and they have a preference actually for the good. So that's the good news, the hopeful news. But then on the other hand, they also seem to have this capacity at a very young age to make a distinction between the in-group and the out-group. And they have a strong preference for the in-group, even if the in-group is being a little bit nasty to the out-group. So, yeah, again, it's a paradoxical view of human nature here. Now, I think that this is not sort of inevitable. Often, I think you should sort of see our capacity for tribalism as a button that can be pushed in our brains, but we can go in another direction as well. It's quite easy to hate someone who's far away from you, who's like a statistic or someone on the news or like the stranger or the immigrant that you don't really connect with. But it's quite difficult to hate someone who's standing in front of you, because once you start talking to other people, once you start, you know, seeing their faces, you can look into their eyes, and human beings have very special eyes. We can actually follow each other's gazes. All the other primates, and there are 200 primate species in total, they've got dark around their eyes. So they're a little bit like poker players wearing shades. And we also have the unique ability to blush, which is, I thought that was totally fascinating, is that we're pretty much the only animal in the whole animal kingdom that blush. We involuntarily give away our feelings to other people. So then it becomes much easier to trust people. And this is something we have to keep in mind all the time when we design our institutions. You got to design and optimize for diversity so that from a very young age, people are used to meeting different people all the time. And then it becomes much harder to hate.
Yeah, I'm glad you went there, because I wanted to kind of move into capitalism and institutions. And because in Humankind, you argue against the prominence of human greed and self-interest. Mm-hmm. Yet a lot of our economic and political systems take this as their starting point. So in other words, kind of defining our species, as you put it, homo economicus. You've also said that you are not advocating for no society without government. So mm-hmm. I guess with this in mind, how would you, or how could our systems be improved? What would you advocate for?
Well, I'm an anarchist who believes in the state. And that sounds a bit strange, maybe.
Yeah.
But if you would sum up anarchism, it would be something like, in the first place, most people are pretty decent. In the second place, power corrupts. Now, the only problem with anarchism is that they're not really good at building institutions. And institutions are the things that change our lives, that produce society. So if you want to change the world, don't bother changing yourselves. Don't read self-help books because they're not going to help anyone. But think about how you can change the school that you sent your kids to. Think about how you can change the workplace, how you can change prisons or the way we do democracy. Because, I mean, these institutions produce society and they change the people around you, including yourself. So that's what I'm really interested in and talking about in the second half of the book. Can we take this theory, this more hopeful view of human nature, and apply it on an institutional level? Because so often we have schools and workplaces that seem to be designed around the idea that people can't be trusted and that you need hierarchy, that you need to control them, that you can't rely on their intrinsic motivation. And I think we can turn it around. And I really try to look at a lot of case studies of people who are already trying to build different kind of schools where kids get much more freedom and they mix all the ages, and you mix all the academic levels, and it's much more about cooperation. And also workplaces. I think we've seen a lot of innovation in the past couple of decades where, yeah, workplaces are more decentralized, where there's a less strict hierarchy. And often the results have been quite encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously, I'm part of the communications creative industry. And traditionally, we have a very linear hierarchy and structure. And what we're finding is that the more we kind of break down and decentralize our teams into autonomous units, the more productive, the better output, the more empowered teams feel. And I know you've researched or spoken to an organization in the Netherlands called Bertzorg, the healthcare company. And I thought that would be an interesting anecdote and for you to provide some insight to our audience as a local example.
Yes, it's a fascinating organization. So Joost de Blok is the founder. He's a nurse himself and then became a manager in healthcare in the Netherlands. And he thought it was a totally frustrating experience. He thought that, you know, much of the work he was doing was, well, not very necessary. So he started a new organization called Buurtzorg, which translates like a bit like neighborhood care. They started with two self-directed teams in the east of the Netherlands, and now they have 15,000 employees, hundreds and hundreds of self-directed teams of nurses. And they've ditched all the management. So they've got pretty much no management at all. These teams decide for themselves who they want to hire as colleagues, what kind of additional education they need, you know, how they're going to plan the whole week. And the results have been really, really extraordinary. I mean, nowadays, experts from around the globe come and visit Joost de Blok in this town of Almelo, which is like the ugliest place in the Netherlands. And they sit in his very ugly office and drive in his very ugly car. He's a very interesting guy, because if you listen to him, he doesn't really sound like a great thinker. He says things like, management is you just got to trust people, blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But then you look at his organization and it's just amazing, because the results speak for themselves. He delivers healthcare at a higher quality, at a cheaper cost, and he pays his employees a higher salary at the same time.
Feels like a win-win.
Yeah, I think the existence of Buurtzorg is like insulting to to all his competitors in healthcare, because it just shows that he can do pretty much everything better by ditching the management. And I think this is something to keep in mind, is that a more hopeful view of human nature is often quite threatening to those at the top, because it means we don't need them. If you really believe that most people are decent and can be trusted, then why do you still need all the kings and the queens and the generals and the presidents and the CEOs and the managers? I'm not saying that, you know, all management is or anything like that.
Sure.
But it does make you think. If you look at a very complicated field like healthcare, and you look at the most successful organization we have in the Netherlands and maybe even in Europe, and they have almost no management, it does make you think, you know, can this model be replicated elsewhere?
I've been thinking about the same thing, and I'll make a leap, so forgive me. But, you know, at the beginning of the book, you talk about civilization has changed from our nomadic beginnings into systems of agriculture, industry, environmental manipulation. And it kind of poses the question to me, which I'll pose to you, is like, do you view civilization as a somewhat unnatural state for us in terms of the natural order of the world? there are examples in nature that have fought back from the progress or the development of humanity. The reemergence of forests in Chernobyl, more biodiversity at Mururoa or Bikini Atoll. These are just two examples where nature has fought back. So I guess given the state of climate change and our collective inaction, have we lost the connection to the natural world?
Well, I think that natural is a little bit of a dangerous word because it assumes that there's something of an original state. While it is in our nature to be cultural, that is what we are as a species. We are a highly flexible species that can behave in very different ways in different circumstances. I do think it's important to know where we've come from. It's important to know that for 95% of our existence, we were nomadic hunter-gatherers. But already back then, we were developing all kinds of new technologies all the time and changing our environments and burning down forests on a huge scale, you know? The invention of fire was one of the first inventions we did, and that radically changed the whole planet. So, yeah, I'm a little bit wary of those who see human beings as this, I don't know, this virus or this thing that is changing everything and that now nature is fighting back. I mean, nature is not fighting back. Nature is just nature and it'll be fine with or without us or whatever, right? And the planet doesn't really care, I think, in the long run. But yeah, as I said, it's important to know where we come from. And it's important to realize that, yeah, this thing we call civilization arose in a very unusual set of circumstances with a relatively stable climate. And now we're leaving that world. And it's scary. It's genuinely very scary because we don't really know what it means. And then the question is, have we been dancing on top of a volcano? And can we manage the transition to a more sustainable society? I don't know yet. I'm not an optimist, but I am hopeful because I think hope is something of a moral duty because it impels you to act.
Yeah, and to give you a practical example, I mean, here in Amsterdam, the city council is progressing the implementation of what they call a donut economic strategy. I don't know if you've heard it. One of the authors and proponents is Kate Raworth, and she advocates for city planning that's in aligned to biomimicry, ecologically in an equilibrium to create a fairer society. Do you believe in it? Is that a step in the right direction, or is that just an idea that may or may not work?
Oh, I think it's one of the many promising ideas out there. We've really seen a shift, you know, an intellectual shift in the past 10 years, where so many ideas that used to be dismissed as crazy have been moving into the mainstream, whether it's higher taxes on the rich or universal basic income or a Green New Deal or donut economy. You know, it's really exciting to see that these ideas that used to be, you know, just being discussed in academic journals that no one ever read are now being discussed on a serious policymaking level.
That's exactly where I was going, because then at a more global level, whether it's the US or the UK or perhaps, I guess what you would call progressive policy circles, the words Green New Deal are starting to emerge and people are starting to understand the policy. And it talks about cutting things like carbon emissions to zero and retraining workers in sustainable industries. Is that the best example of collective action and policy progress that you know of? And does it address, maybe this is too harsh of a term, but our faults in our own human nature?
I think that people on the right are often naive about climate science, but then people on the left are often a bit naive about climate action, that they don't fully realize just how radical the transformation of our whole economy needs to be. I mean, you can say it easily, right? You can say, oh, we need to halve carbon emissions in 2030 and move to zero carbon emissions in 2050. But then you look at the graph and it's like this incredibly steep decline, which basically represents a huge revolution, a technological transformation that, I mean, there are very little similar examples of that in all of history. Most people then come up with the wartime mobilization example of how the US and the UK and other countries totally changed their whole economy in just a couple of years, you know, to produce as many tanks and bombs and grenades as possible. But that was not a comfortable process, you know. That was a very harsh, difficult process where taxes went up to astronomical levels and companies were basically being bullied to change their whole production and to be able to win the war. So I'm happy to see that we're making progress here and that more and more people are just starting to realize how dire the situation is. But I think we're not nearly there yet. Because, really moving to a sustainable energy system. I mean, we got to change everything, right? The way we consume, the way we travel, the what we eat, et cetera, et cetera. There's just so much work to be done. We're moving in the right direction, but not fast enough.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I wanted to kind of get your understanding on what new systems could arise, both for, I guess, the individual and society at large. So plainly speaking, coming from a creative industry, I'm naturally interested in creative processes. But you've previously said that when we lift people out of poverty, their IQ goes up, and you've hypothesized that if there was a universal basic income, people were freed from meaningless jobs. Just imagine the creativity and the explosion of energy and ideas that the world would see. So I love that thought, but have you come across any good examples of this, either through UBI or anti-poverty measures, where creativity or entrepreneurialism has flourished?
Yeah, I mean, we've had many experiments with basic income throughout the world, basically since the 1970s. So what you see most of the time is that crime goes down, kids do better in school, people find new jobs, they start new companies, et cetera, et cetera. So poverty is just an extraordinary waste of human capital and talent. Just think about how many Einsteins we've lost to poverty. I mean, you don't necessarily have to be an Einstein. Just think about how many garbage collectors and teachers and nurses we've lost to poverty. But the same is actually true, not only for those at the bottom of society, but also for the top. I think, again, it's the waste of talent that worries me. There are so many people stuck in jobs these days that don't really seem to matter to them. Sending emails to people they don't like, writing reports no one's ever going to read, creating ads to buy products that people don't need to impress people they don't like. I mean, the lack of meaning is really a depressing phenomenon in the current job market. And what's striking to me is that often the people who consider their own job socially meaningless often have terrific resumes. They went to brilliant universities, had excellent marks at school, but then still they have the feeling that they're wasting their talent. So that's really one of the great tragedies. And I think that a universal basic income can play a part in turning that around. It can help us move towards a society where the social value of the job will be reflected by the wages. And that actually, if you do work that really matters, you'll be paid better. And that maybe the COVID crisis helps here as well, because we've had all these lists of the so-called essential workers, the nurses and the teachers, etc. And you look at these lists and you're like, hey, where are the hedge fund managers? You know, they're not on the list. So maybe yeah. They're not as essential as we used to think.
I want to talk about meaning and value. And around the backdrop of last year, the Business Roundtable, a collective of more than 180 CEOs, and mainly based in the US, released a statement committing themselves to a realignment of business focus. So in short, moving away from shareholder primacy and a commitment that includes all stakeholders, such as employees, customers, communities. In essence, they were saying, we're going to shift the focus of our business and our business objectives from shareholder to stakeholder value. And the argument is that previously CEOs worked to generate profits and return to value to shareholders, and best run companies do more, that they put the customer first and they invest in their employees and communities. And in the end, that's the most promising way to build long-term value. Have you heard of this? Do you buy it? And do you think employees and customers and communities should have more of a direct stake in the employer or their business?
Oh, absolutely. I think that there are already many examples of that throughout the world. So, for example, if you compare Germany to, say, the US, in Germany already, you know, employees have a much bigger stake in the companies. And then you already get a very different kind of capitalism. This is what bothers me often, is that people have these big discussions about capitalism versus communism, or the market versus the state. Well, there are actually many, many different ways to organize capitalism and to give people and employees and citizens a voice. And then you can still have a system that's sort of capitalistic, but very different. I mean, Norway is a capitalist economy. Sweden is a capitalist economy, but they still have universal healthcare and, you know, a much stronger welfare state. And actually, I think it often helps markets to work better, because you know, people get the ability to develop their talents, et cetera, and businesses benefit from that as well. So I think it's a move in the right direction. You obviously have to wait first. I mean, words are one thing. Action is the next thing. But yeah, the sort of the shareholder model has in practice often been a model of rent seeking, where basically you have companies that are stealing value that is created by other people. and they themselves are not really contributing.
Yeah, because if they're going to be action orientated, and if the business roundtable is actually for real, then do you have issues with the fact that business is in fact taking up that mantle from government in terms of establishing a more egalitarian view on capitalism and society?
I'm not dogmatic about any of these things. So
yeah,
I think that markets have a role to play, governments have a role to play, and sometimes just people organizing themselves in what we call the commons have a role to play. You should have institutional diversity. And some things, well, some things companies are really good at. If you think about mobile phones or the telephone market, privatization has done some good things. I think there's evidence for that. But then if you look at other things like privatization as healthcare, it has been a disaster in pretty much every place. And universal healthcare is a way better model than what they have in the US. So I think you shouldn't be too dogmatic about any of these things. I do think, though, that once you adopt something like a basic income, that maybe your society will transform to a kind of capitalism that maybe we'll call post-capitalism, or that it's that it will function work so much differently from what it used to be, because people don't have to be afraid of poverty anymore and they can just rely on their intrinsic motivation. They don't need to work because of fear, but can work because of they hope to do something and want to contribute. Yeah, I think that can be a very different kind of society.
Yeah, because I want to connect that point into our conversation around, I guess, what you could call the social contract between big tech and society. So, again, my premise being, as designers, marketeers, and technologists, we all use data and network platforms. It doesn't matter whether we're delivering stories, driving traffic, converting commerce, or creating connections. Actually, a term I like is the surveillance economy, which is something that an author, Shoshana Zuboff, in her latest book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, she describes an economic business model that commoditizes human identity for the profit of corporations and for the power of government. And I guess to our audience, if you've ever watched Westworld or Devs, these shows kind of paint a dystopian future of what the current trajectory of big tech could turn out to be. Now, I've gone into my cynical dark place again, so apologies. But how do you view the state of technology in relation to human nature and personal identity privacy?
Yeah, I'm highly skeptical of that argument that we're already in this kind of surveillance economy where we're being ruled by, you know, companies like Google and Facebook. I think it's sort of conspiracy theory for liberals that they... I don't know. It seems to be grounded in a simplistic view of human nature, that we're easily being manipulated and moved into this direction or that direction. It also reminds me of this other book that was so popular, The Nudge Book by Cass Sunstein and Richard Taylor. They had this theory that you can nudge people in all kinds of directions if you just make small changes in their circumstances. For example, you change a sentence in a letter from the tax authorities and then suddenly people start paying their taxes or something like that. All this research doesn't replicate very well. And if you think about it, that makes sense because people's lives are complicated. There's a lot of stuff going on in them. So the whole idea that they'll radically change their behavior if you change just one thing in their context, that's just not what happens. On average, effect sizes in research, in social science research, are really small. Remember the Cambridge Analytica story? Yeah. You know, that was, again, the conspiracy theory for liberals. Oh, we lost the election. What happened? Well, we don't want to talk about the total failure of the Democrats. We want to talk about Russia. We want to talk about, you know, Cambridge Analytica. Then if you look at the data set, researchers later found out that with that data set, you couldn't even predict the gender of people accurately based on that data set. And then we were supposed to believe that Cambridge Analytica managed to understand our personalities, you know, like the big five and personality traits, and that with that knowledge, they managed to create an intervention on Facebook that swung the election. I mean, that is nuts to actually believe that. There's no evidence for that at all. So I think this whole notion of the surveillance economy is actually the empirical evidence for that is very thin. And yeah. I think that Google and Facebook have just been really good at, you know, letting us believe that they're all powerful.
Final question time. And this this may be a little more lighthearted, so I'd like to finish on a slightly happier note. But since Utopia for Realists, your profile has risen a lot. You did your TED talk. It's got over a million views. And you've obviously got your very memorable moment of Davos where you pushed the wealthy on taxes, taxes, taxes. What's it been like since all this has happened in your life? Have you met more powerful people? Do you feel you've influenced them? You've created a discourse and a dialogue. How's that impacted you personally? And has it changed your worldview? Or what's the experience been like?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, it's obviously a bit of a strange experience because once you get more well-known, you have less time to actually read and do research. So it feels like a process of dumbing down where you listen more to yourself and listen less to others. So I find that quite uncomfortable about the whole thing. Then you're being invited to join the so-called speaking circuit, where you can make a ridiculous amount of money saying very stupid and simplistic things. So that is a real danger as well that I've tried to steer clear of. So a part of those two dangers, I mean, it's amazing that ideas that I deeply care about are being discussed around the globe. And that, for example, universal basic income was a very marginal idea 6-7 years ago when I first wrote about it. And now it's really on the menu. Now, this obviously doesn't mean that it's my idea. I mean, it's a 200 years old idea and I'm just playing a part in this movement. But it's been really exciting to be there quite early and to be able to be in this privileged position where you can spread those ideas that you really care about.
I grew up in New Zealand, and one of the odd memories I have from, you know, very, very young in primary school was a class trip all about recycling. So for a class trip, we went to a recycling center, which
awesome.
kind of sounds like a sad school trip.
Yeah.
Well, what that experience did is that it embedded the notion of recycling as an idea and the benefits to the environment and the economy. Now, there are lots of negative things you can say about recycling and the cost and the energy that goes into it. Mm-hmm. But at some point, someone had that idea, and that idea trickled down to the education system. That education system decided that was something we should give the kids an experience about. So I wonder if things like universal basic income or an accurate history of racial inequality and gender inequality, or the notion that we went from feudalism to capitalism to post-capitalism. I just wonder what the next thing is that will go into the education system or will be the idea that the youth are embedded with. Does that make sense?
Well, change takes a lot of time, especially in the history of ideas. You need a little bit of patience.
Yeah,
it took 50 years for neoliberalism to take over the world. So we need some patience if we want to update people's view of human nature and to have them consider different ideas and to change the curriculum at schools. I mean, in the book, I talk about some of the psychology experiments that are still so famous today from the 1960s, like the Stanford Prison Experiment and the Milgram experiments that give us a very, well, pessimistic view of human nature that supposedly deep down, or there's a Nazi below the surface in each and every one of us and that we're just savages. We've only recently realized that these experiments are, well, hoaxes in a way, especially the Stanford Prison Experiment. And now they're slowly removing it from the textbooks. But yeah, people have learned about it for 50 years. So it'll take some time before everyone's up to date again. I've thought that for a long time now. I mean, I'm in this for the long run. So if people are desperate or really pessimistic about the state of the world, then I encourage them to zoom out a little bit and think about where we were 10 years ago.
Yeah. And I mean, by trade, you're a journalist, you're a historian, you're a researcher. So I can't imagine you want to stay in the speaker sphere for too long. What's the next thing you're getting into? What's the next book? Where's your attention going to be placed?
I'm not sure, actually. So my process is that I read a lot of stuff that don't seem to be really related. I'm now reading a book about building social infrastructure. I'm really interested in how you design cities to encourage more bicycles, for example.
Yep.
But I'm also reading a lot about climate change, about how you can mobilize an whole economy, about wartime mobilizations. I've recently read a book about how emotions are produced in the brain, which is totally fascinating to me as well. And I have no idea where this will end up. I really believe in sort of not having a plan, especially in sort of the first stages of research. You just got to follow your own curiosity. And at some point you'll realize, hey, this is what I should be writing about.
I think if we were to sum up our conversation today, follow your curiosity, have hope, keep the faith, and give it a little time. And we'll see what, and we'll see where the future leads us.
Excellent.
On behalf of AKQA and AKQA Insight, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. All the best for the future. Please keep in touch and thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening, and please join us for the next episode of AKQA Insight.